if it could only be that easy. But embarking on any new adventure without therapy or feedback from friends at a time like this is dangerous. A good rule may be to have to want something for 30 consecutive days before you decide to proceed with it. This also applies to getting back together. The desire for vengeance against the partner who hurt you will probably arise. This is the ego's way of avoiding grief by substituting retaliation, interaction, for inner action, that is, personal work. During this time, allow any feeling or thought, but refrain from acting on it. In the words of an old saying, any bird can fly over your head, but it is up to you whether it builds a nest in your hair. This is from a letter from a close friend of mine, one whom I admire, during the time of his difficult divorce. I feel I have become a kinder person, not wanting to hurt others. I do have cruel thoughts about how to deal with her, but I don't act on them. I see that she has no peace within herself, and someday she may wake up and change, but that's not my business anymore. This is the sound of an opening heart and a crumbling ego. You may fear that you will never find anyone else. No one will ever want you. This sort of paranoid delusion is to be dismissed as such, but it also serves the grief work. It prevents you from looking for someone else before you're ready to see who you really are. You may be unable to get the other person or the betrayal out of your mind. The ego prefers to choose one side of a polarity and ignore the other, which helps explain the origin and longevity of obsessive thoughts, in which we only focus on one person or one problem. You are not in the control tower. Rather, you are challenged to become the landing strip. Let any thought or feeling pass through. Simply allow feelings and thoughts that they may safely land or crash on you. They are normal and usually fade with time. It is a mistake to recontact a former partner too soon. In this instance, it helps to have an ego that is too proud to beg for contact. When is the time right for reconnecting in a friendly way? Probably when you have stopped obsessing and no longer want or need to change him or her or get even with him or her. The time for recontact is when you no longer need contact but are ready to normalize relations. That happens when the charge is gone. Normalizing relations is especially important when you have children's issues to negotiate. Grief cannot be willed away. It is best not to attempt to let it go, but to let it happen. Allow the grief, the sadness, the anger, the fear. Allow it, that is, allow yourself to take all the time needed, no matter what friends may say, about how long it's supposed to take to, quote, get over it, unquote. Beware of false hopes that arise when a partner who leaves seems to be on the fence about resuming the relationship. This may not be a sign that she wants to reunite. Ambivalence is normal in any breakup. There are usually many back and forth gestures between the statement of an ending and an actual ending. Let time tell you whether there is reasonable hope. A person who has been left may feel like a little boy with hat in hand, waiting for the other to be kind or to relent and take him back. This is a normal way to feel and can lead to a healthy vulnerability for the future. The psyche has many ways of learning to let go of its hardness and let in the light. At the same time, the little begging boy helps you learn that you have expected too much from other people. Here is a love poem by the 6th Dalai Lama. Oh, I demanded so much of you in this short lifetime. Maybe we will find one another again in the beginning of the next. The prophet Jeremiah wrote, "Your wound is beyond healing." This reminds us that every grief has an element of inconsolability. There will always be something unresolved, ineradicable, in a major loss. Such inconsolability is familiar from childhood. It is what fueled the longing for the perfect partner. Unfortunately, it often becomes synonymous with a sense of unlovability, so we cannot let in 100% of the love that comes our way in adult life. The scars left by grief can be ugly for years or can heal reasonably well. The outcome depends on the skill of our grief work. Just as scars on our body show the varying levels of the skill of the doctors who treated us over the years. If your relationship ended when your partner found someone new, how would you feel about writing a letter to the intruder? It would simply state what you have been feeling and going through as a result of the betrayal. Not eating, not sleeping, crying all the time, obsessive thoughts. The motive of this impact letter is not to change anything. It is simply to let the intruder know what happened to you as a result of her willingness to enter a relationship with someone who was not yet finished with her own partner. Do not attempt this unless you expect no answer and have no wish to hurt anyone. An alternative is to write it and not mail it. Resist the wish to tell your partner one last thing or give him one necessary piece of information that is actually an argument meant to manipulate him into whatever response you desire. Tell it to the moon instead, and the goddess there will make sure he finds out just what he needs to know. Here's a poem by Chang Chu Ling. A full moon poised above the sea makes the face of heaven radiant and brings to hearts that are apart the poignant pensiveness of night. I blow out my candle, but it is just as bright here. I put on a coat, but it is just as cold. So I can only read my message to the moon as I lay myself down and long for dreams of you. Read the following paragraph slowly and then sit meditatively. They summarize the spiritual process we have been learning and apply it to endings and other kinds of crises. The neurotic pastimes of the ego, fear, attachment, blame, complaint, expectation, judgment, preference, attachment to outcomes, the need to fix things, control, attraction, aversion, create intrusion. The practice of mindfulness can liberate me from such limiting shelters and help me face my experience fearlessly just as it is. If my world crumbles, then the resulting groundlessness is a liberating invitation to reinvent my life. In fact, without the customary ground on which to run away from it, I can befriend my suffering unconditionally. Mindfulness is like seeing something for the first time, without the distracting intrusions of ego, and hence another name for it is beginner's mind. Beginner's mind offers me a way of working with reality rather than against it. The point of the practice is not to calm our inner storm or manage it, but to sit quietly in its eye and thereby to mirror and receive its energy. My frantic attempts to fix a painful collapse are a way of running from that possibility. My predicament is myself, no matter how negative or scary it may be. All my avoidances of it are escapes from the full impact of my life as it is now and the teaching it is meant to impart to me. The wisdom is in not escaping at all. Mindfulness is not about becoming composed, but about composing ourselves fully in our here and now, truly mirroring our immediate reality. Meaninglessness occasionally greets me in the course of life. When I allow it, move into it, let myself be with it, and stay through it, I feel lighter, that is, enlightened. To allow is not to wallow. I wallow when I become a victim of my thoughts. I allow a felt sense of its darkness to arise in my body, free of thought, full of space. This is body mindfulness. I now practice a nonverbal attention to my body parts, gradually, from soul to crown, while releasing any tension stored in them. Whatever my current negative thought or feeling, it is bearable when it is granted the hospitality of mindful awareness. Then I have pure experiences with Zen-like immediacy. For example, I see one lilac without a wish for more, or taste one apple without a fear of not having enough. I am thankful that I cannot outsmart the ways of the universe. May I honor my confusions as my path. May everything that happens expose my self-deceptions and my attempts at hiding out. May my body become my witness and my teacher. May my current predicaments and all my practice bring happiness to every living being. May my former partner become an enlightened Buddha. Part 3, Returning the Blessing. Beginning with a quotation from Rainer Maria Rilke. Once we accept that even between the closest human beings, infinite distances continue to exist, we can live wonderfully side by side. As long as we succeed in loving the distance between one another, each of us can see each other as whole against the sky. Chapter 9, Our Commitment and How It Deepens. By coming home, the heroine of an heroic journey shows she has attained a higher consciousness about herself and the world. Coming home in this case is a metaphor for realizing that all we need is within us and within the hearts of those around us. Feeling the need for a relationship is thus a homing instinct, one consistent with the intent of the universe. In the culminating phase of a relationship, our love is not limited to one person, but reaches out to the entire world. We can attain universal compassion through the experience of loving one person. How? By commitment, giving and receiving the 5 A's, working problems out, and keeping agreements. Doing all this within our immediate partnership softens us to the point where we can do it with others. Success in this relationship makes us believe it is possible everywhere. The obstacles in our life become bridges. But what exactly happens in us to open us to the world? In a committed relationship, we finally let go of our ego's formidable insistence on being right, on getting our way, on competing and winning. We may still have arguments, but they do not last as long. They end in resolution, and they involve less replay of the past. We take the content of the argument as information rather than as grist for the mill of resentment. Instead of demanding that our expectations be met, we seek agreements. We may still fight, but we do not stop loving. We can take each other's ego more lightly. We cease to use our power over one another, but instead find ways to use power for the common goals of the relationship. We are describing the third phase of a relationship. The first phase was romance, the second was conflict, the third is commitment. During this commitment phase, we begin to notice a humorous insubstantiality, like the no-self in Buddhism, a humorous insubstantiality in the posturings we devise in the face of conflicts. We cannot substantiate the claim that our positions are quite so non-negotiable once compassion and wisdom bathe them fully. We look with mild amusement at what once seemed so enormous, and we let go of our seriousness, finally having recognized it as a form of pain. Now pain opens in a new way and leads us to compassion and change, not blame and shame. Once we realize that we are capable of anything that humans do, we are not so threatened by the hurtful behavior of others, and compassion flourishes. As Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche said, the bodhisattva is never surprised. Bodhisattva is an enlightened person who keeps coming back to help the rest of us find enlightenment. An intimate adult's commitment is based on informed consent. I now know the architecture of your ego and the unlit corners of your shadow, and I commit myself to you with my eyes wide open. The territoriality and competitiveness of ego are loosening in me. Before, I wanted to possess you to gratify my ego. Now I am dispossessing myself of ego to strengthen our relationship. The compelling force of romance gives way to the impelling choice of real engagement. This is the time for marriage. Partners now accept each other as perfect, but only the way an old shirt is perfect. Real love looks different in each phase of a relationship. Although an oak looks different in spring, summer, fall, and winter, it is always an oak. We give the 5 A's romantically in the romance phase, dramatically in the conflict phase, and serenely and reliably in the commitment phase. And this is also the phase when we bring those 5 A's to others in the wider world. The practices suggested in this book are not meant just to make my relationship better, but to make all relationships better. Our relationship journey thus mirrors our journey to creative human fulfillment. Our interpersonal goals become interpersonal and then transpersonal. The phases of relationships take us from an ego ideal through a conflicted ego and its shadow side to a self that transcends ego and then embraces the universe. This is the same sequence that can happen within us, not only between us. We can discover the all-embracing circle of psychology and spirituality in the realm of relating. As Emily Dickinson said, "My business is circumference." The psychological problems we have in a relationship are the shadow side of our spiritual potential. There is no clear division between the psychological and the spiritual, only a distinction. We can become so caught up in our own story with all its past and present conflicts that we lose perspective. Then we fail to realize what Shakespeare says in Coriolanus. There is a world elsewhere. When something beyond our past and our relationships absorbs and animates us, we open to new potentials in the world and in ourselves. We let go of the past to create the future. Together we engage in a social cause, family concerns, service, career, religion, spirituality, or other world-changing enterprises. No transformation is entirely personal because goodness cannot help but diffuse itself. Our partnership expands to include the whole world, and we contribute to planetary evolution. The original goal of leaving home to start a home of one's own expands to become the more general goal of making the world a home for all people. When we make a commitment to a partner by giving the 5 A's, we also become carriers and providers of these 5 aspects of love to the wider world. The virtues of intimate love. I trust a lively energy in and between us. There is an inborn organismic wisdom in our bodies. This wisdom knows and accesses our potential. It is homeostatic in that any imbalance that arises in our psyche body immediately engages an inner resource to correct itself. David Palmer, the founder of chiropractic, called this wisdom the innate intelligence of the body. By this he meant an instinct in every cell that promotes balance, healing, and regeneration. He later referred to a universal intelligence in the cosmos, and finally he realized that this universal intelligence and our innate intelligence are one and the same. This is equivalent to saying that our bodily wisdom is infinite and infinitely accessible, that our core and the core of the world are the same, as is the core of the divine. If we keep this in mind, we will realize our needs because the 5 A's are not inadequacies. Rather, they are our life force. To trust ourselves is to believe that our needs and feelings are precisely the invincible power that makes it possible to withstand the full force of reality, to handle the conditions of existence, and to respond accordingly. If I run from reality or disguise or deform it, my lively energy is lost in the shuffle. That is ultimately the meaning of low self-esteem, of perceiving myself as a victim, and of childish neediness. Lively energy has a unique shape in each of us. For instance, if I never had a period of time alone, without a parent or partner in my life, I may never have found my personal liveliness. Liveliness means allowing feelings, and trust grows when I show and receive feelings. I may never have felt my deeper feelings and become comfortable with them. I may believe that I can only find or maintain my own lively energy in the context of a relationship. This sense of need may be a signal of how I have lost touch with myself. Another way of saying this might be, I have avoided allowing my true self to emerge by always making sure that I have someone in my life. I have used relationships to find out who I am, which means I never really find out who I am, since that takes time alone. Lively energy makes us trust ourselves more and more. A person with self-trust knows that a healthy relationship is not based on absolute trust in anyone else. No one is trustworthy all the time. Adult relationships are based on acceptance of that given of human fallibility, not on rigid trust, but on flexible, unconditional love that allows us to get angry about betrayal, but then leaves us enough heart to forgive it when a partner apologizes, makes amends, and truly changes. When we find the five A's, attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing, in someone, we trust him or her and feel supported. We trust ourselves when we give ourselves these same five A's. To trust someone is to let in his love and handle his failings, and to do both fearlessly. To do this is an exacting adult task. I trust myself to receive your love and loyalty when you are loving and loyal. I trust myself to confront and handle your betrayals, not letting you get away with them, but not going away from you because of them unless you refuse to stop them. To trust our lively energy is no longer to need others to protect us from our feelings and the impact of our experience. We no longer say, "Be nice to me and never hurt me, so that I will never have to feel bad." Do I want an adult-to-adult relationship, or do I want a safe harbor from the stormy vicissitudes of intimacy? Ending with a quotation from Shakespeare, from Othello. "Where's that palace where into foul things sometimes intrude not?" Giving and receiving in intimacy reflect a healthy dual process that we see in most areas of human life. For instance, our body survives by letting both oxygen in and letting carbon dioxide out. Cells are porous in order to let in nutrients and excrete waste. We communicate both by speaking and listening. Spiritually, we receive grace and give love. Even reading this book means taking in words and ideas and then putting them out into the world, into practice. What we give and receive in an intimate relationship exactly matches both our earliest needs and our adult spiritual practice, the five A's. We give to the other and receive from her the very same love we instinctively required in childhood. The difference is that now we see it as an enriching gift, desired instead of required. It helps us increase our self-esteem now, just as it was necessary for establishing a self-concept in early life. How exactly do we give and receive? The first way is a simple, difficult technique. Ask for what you want and listen to your partner. Asking for what you want combines the most crucial elements of intimacy. It gives the other the gift of knowing you, your needs, and your vulnerability. It also means receiving the other's free response. Both are risky, and therefore both make you more mature. You learn to let go of your insistence on a yes, to be vulnerable to a no, and to accept a no without feeling the need to punish. To listen intimately to a partner asking for what he wants is to pick up on the feeling and need beneath the request. It is to appreciate where the request came from. It is to feel compassion for any pain that may lurk in the request. It is to give the other credit for risking rejection or misunderstanding. We hear with our ears, we listen with our intuition and our heart. Giving and receiving entail the ability to accommodate the full spectrum of a partner's fears and foibles, and to distinguish between needs we can and cannot expect to see fulfilled. A second way intimate adults give and receive is through mutually chosen sex and playfulness. You make love when both of you want it, not when one of you pushes the other into it. You can be intimate without having to be sexual. You know how to have fun together. You play without hurting each other, without engaging in sarcasm or ridicule, without laughing at each other's shortcomings. Finally, we give and receive by granting equality, freedom from hierarchy. Only the healthy ego and not another person is meant to preside over your life. In true intimacy, partners have an equal voice in decision-making. One partner does not insist on dominating or controlling the other. Granted, some couples choose to experiment with submission dominance in sex, This can be a form of play since it involves roles and can be a healthy choice when it is mutual. But if it has a compulsive or violent dimension, it may be a reenactment of abuse from childhood. What is the difference between a submissive erotic style and low self-esteem or no boundaries? Submission dominance is an erotic game chosen intentionally and consensually. It is not a rut partners fall into by default, or when one partner's demands take precedence over the other's needs. It is willing and not unwilling, conscious, not unconscious. It is joyful instead of fearsome. It transforms rather than deforms love and respect, expanding rather than shrinking the boundaries of self-discovery. Healthy submission dominance is not a way of gaining power over someone, but a way of playing out inclinations that are in all of us, but may never have found legitimate expression. As long as it is not abusive, it can enhance the relationship and teach the partners about themselves, their egos, their limits, and the undiscovered parts of their identities. How to show anger with a loving intent. Closeness evokes both affection and aggression, love and hate. This ambivalence, which is normal, can tear us apart like horses pulling us in opposite directions. Or we can accept it as a given of human relating. In committed intimacy, I can be angry at you and still love you. I can let you get mad at me without having to get mad at you. Real relating includes being with and standing against one another. You can be angry at me and oppose me, and all the while I know you still love me. I can do the same with you. Anger does not have us. We have anger. Discrete instances of anger cannot muddle or obstruct the flowing of our ongoing love. The fully actualized self can acknowledge and experience the entire range of human feelings. To say we are incapable of rage, for instance, is to deny our inclination toward aggression that helps us fight injustice in the world. We impoverish ourselves and others when we fear or inhibit our human powers. If we cannot feel all the polarities of human emotion safely and fully, how can we experience the equanimity that is so necessary to fulfillment? Closely connected to anger, the desire to retaliate is ingrained in us. This is not a sign of moral degeneracy, but a natural automatic survival reaction to threat or abuse. Our work, which both goes against our natural inclination and advances our natural evolution, is to accept this as a given of human nature while choosing not to act it out. This does not mean not acting at all, but rather finding a way of expressing anger without having to hurt or retaliate against others. Such nonviolent resistance flows from higher consciousness rather than instinct, and makes the world a more mindful and loving place. Some of us have, consciously or unconsciously, sworn an oath of loyalty to the god of revenge. Hate is strong anger felt by the neurotic ego that has become stuck in the desire to keep retaliating. People who hate and retaliate have a tentative and tattered sense of self. Indeed, hate may serve some functions when our inner self is damaged, providing a sense of coherence when we feel fragmented, proving to ourselves that we exist, giving us a sense of control. But these are ultimately all strategies of agony and hopefully elicit compassion in us when we see someone else caught up in them. When we are adult, we can hold and experience apparently contradictory feelings or conditions. For instance, we can be committed to someone and maintain personal boundaries, have a conflict with someone and be working on it, feel anger and be loving. We can feel abandoned while we remain committed to showing love. In fact, we can go on loving in any predicament, a touching example of how our psychological work can set a spiritual standard. To see others as good or bad is to split the world into those who evoke love and those who evoke hate. Internally, our love will feel like longing, and our hate will hide our fear. When we become comfortable with anger, we form an arc of connection that makes us feel we are whole and that others are whole too. What propels and sustains us in intimacy is love that is comfortable with other feelings. then anger is a normal and occasional reaction that never cancels love. Compare the big and generously expressed anger in nature to the constricted anger of a disgruntled neighbor. Nature's great lightning bolt is so unlike the neighbor's minced words and grumbling, downcast face. As adults, we have fearlessly and trenchantly to demonstrate our anger because it is a loud and serious cry for help in mending the relationship. Thus, only a caring person shows true anger, which opens to love when it is received with the five A's. This is how it coexists with intimacy and helps us grow. I maintain my boundaries while I remain close to you. In the Eastern view, the idea that we each have a separate identity is illusory, the result of a flaw in consciousness. But the spiritual truth of this perspective does not eliminate our psychological need for boundaries that safeguard us against predations and assaults from others. Ultimately, we are pure space, but as Shakespeare says, whilst this muddy vesture of decay doth grossly close us in, we cannot appreciate it. It is convenient to operate as if we had an identity and it needed defending. While our spiritual destiny is to acknowledge oneness, our psychological task is to let go of our belief in oneness. For though there is no solid, separate, independent self, each of us has an inviolate, inalienable core of personal responsibility and rights. That core is our healthy ego, a provisional but legitimate feature of who we are. Boundaries protect our commitment and ourselves. A person without boundaries makes her commitment to the maintenance of their partnership, not to its workability. With clear boundaries, on the other hand, we see when a relationship is not working and enlist our partner to work on it with us. If he agrees and joins us, we are encouraged. If he declines, we hear that message and act on it by asking more emphatically, or if the no is unalterable and unacceptable, by moving on. To value one another for more than the five A's. To maintain a relationship during periods when your needs are not being met means valuing your partner for himself, whether or not you are receiving the five A's continually. It means that it is all right with you, and vice versa, that one of you is weak or needy or not available at times. Yet if it happens too often, if your partner is an addict, for instance, you have an issue to address. Am I a partner here or a caretaker? Each partner in a loving bond takes responsibility to find the help he needs so that he can fulfill his partnership role of granting the five A's. While it is useful to speak honestly to a partner who is an addict, it is useless to keep nagging him to quit. The best approach seems to be to state the truth and offer support in his following a program of recovery. If he refuses, the rule is to show, not tell. An addict who refuses help is basically killing himself, and the appropriate response is mourning, grieving for an end about to happen. To say, I am beginning the grieving process for you, is to express your truth, not tell him his. It is a ruthlessly adult response to the facts at hand. If I am addicted to alcohol, I cannot fulfill my part of our contract. I cannot provide even moderate nurturance or focus on you. If I refuse help, even after you confront me, I am choosing to go farther and farther away from you. This suggests that you might take the next step you can, for example, getting involved in Al-Anon. There is a fine line between a mature choice to stay with someone who does not fulfill our needs and the mature choice to tolerate the situation temporarily. A healthy person acknowledges the difference between occasional, circumstantial, and ongoing certain. We are not respecting ourselves when we put up with a general pattern of negativity or hardly any need fulfillment or happiness. But we are respecting our commitment when we tolerate occasional periods of deficiency. In fact, since adult growth includes mourning, losses, and changes, there will always be periods when one or both partners will be sad or angry or depressed or afraid, and thereby unable to focus wholeheartedly on the other. To acknowledge that sometimes a person comes through for us and sometimes he does not. To respect his distresses and the damaged areas in his psyche is a form of tolerance that makes for spiritual compassion. I make allowance for this because I know or can guess how you must feel. Essential means intrinsic and abiding. Existential means here and now, experiential. An essential bond is a given of intimate relating. Physical, maybe. Psychological and spiritual, usually. Like all energy, it cannot be created or destroyed. It comes fully into evidence only in the conflict stage of a relationship. The bond in the romance stage consists of excitement, neediness, and attachment to an ideal. The bond that develops in conflict and in working through conflict is the lasting one, no longer dependent on whether you are getting along or are still together. Like the bond of religion, it can even survive our leaving it. An essential bond in a relationship goes on after divorce. It is the unconditional connection, the unconditional love, that can be dismantled but never demolished. We manifest this essential bond of love by making an existential commitment, a day-to-day choice, to address, process, and resolve issues, and to keep the agreements that arise from them. When a new, more appealing person comes along, we take that as information, not as permission to leave. We have made a commitment to stay with a partner as long as she and we are both engaged in a relationship that is effective, or one in which both are working on the relationship to make it effective. Dogged determination is not commitment. Marriage is not commitment. Living together is not commitment. A healthy person loves unreservedly, but does not make an unreserved commitment. A healthy person can decide the extent and the length of his commitment. If it were not this way, commitment would mean submission, no boundaries, no sense of self-worth, no sense of self. An adult makes a commitment to a person with whom things are working or workable. She withdraws this commitment when things are no longer workable. Unlike a commitment, a vow is a promise to remain attached to a relationship whether or not it works, whether or not it is workable. Since the purpose of a relationship is human happiness, not conservation of an institution such as marriage, commitment is reasonable and vows are dangerous. A commitment is to workability, a vow is to time. Example, till death us do part. Moreover, vows can be subtle attempts to exempt ourselves from the painful givens of human relating. The other may betray, hurt, or leave us. As adults, we realize that vows and plans are really nothing more than wishes. They are certainly not the laws by which relationships operate. The sociologist scholar of religion, Mircea Eliade, writes about the hero, quote, "The law of life lives in him with his unreserved consent," unquote. Intimacy has become complete when an essential bond is energized by an existential commitment. This means a series of kept agreements and handled obstacles, the core of an adult commitment. Adults can go on loving a partner unconditionally, but not stay in a relationship with him if the relationship has become unworkable. I love you no matter what, but I can't live with you. Here our distinction between the essential bond, I love you no matter what, and the existential commitment, I can't live with you, is crucial. The bond of love goes on unimpeded by events, but the day-to-day commitment is entirely conditioned by them. An adult combines unconditional love with conditional commitment. This equates to the sane embrace instead of the addictive clutch. A parent has unconditional love for and makes an unconditional commitment to a child. An adult has unconditional love for and makes a conditional commitment to a partner. Unconditional love is a spiritual victory, since it really means unconditioned by ego, fear, attachment, control, or entitlement. We show unconditional love for what is unconditioned, the basic goodness in others, we show conditional love for what is conditioned, the multiform personality of ego. To say I can love you and leave you is as healthy as to say I can fear something and do it. In codependence, the less we get the five A's, the more of them do we give. We hope the giving will lead the other to give us more love. Since we do not feel loved enough, we believe we must not be giving enough. We keep giving more, but since we do not feel loved enough, we believe we must not be giving enough. We are attempting to get by giving instead of by sharing in an equal exchange. The result is guilt. On a humorous but sobering note, I must confess that the virtuous elements of intimacy outlined in the preceding sections describe what an object relation psychology is supposed to be in place for individual development by age 3. Soulmates. The inflated ego gives only partial knowledge of who we are. Clinging to our ego is like living under an assumed name, one that conceals our wholeness, our potential to give and receive unconditional love, pure attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. Individuals come along to give us these five A's. We imagine that John or Mary is our other half, and we abandon our connection and commitment to our own other half. The archetypal animus or anima, the male and female energies in all of us. It is as if we had an archetypal Robin Hood, a personification of kind-heartedness and heroism within ourselves. But we automatically picture him, Robin Hood, as John. We let the literal external person take the place of the internal metaphorical personification of our powers. Instead of imitating Robin Hood, as we did in childhood, we revere the John who represents Robin Hood. We thereby diminish our own spiritual stature and potential. We break the engagement with our full self for a marriage with someone else, when actually we need both unions. We confuse our intrapersonal work with our interpersonal needs. Only the inner Robin Hood in the Sherwood forest of our psyche has the authentic lively energy that will never die or disappear, the energy powerful enough to join the inner maid Marion in the cooperative venture of adult love. A woman's soul mate is not the man who takes over a woman's functions, but the one who mirrors them with pleased encouragement. The image of this seductive person or that former partner will visit us in a dream or sustain us in a crisis or wake us up at 3 a.m. when we are at our lowest ebb. She or he has a hold on us by virtue of an image. It looks as if she offers the fulfillment that is actually available only from the feminine self. It looks as if he offers the fulfillment that is actually available only from the masculine self. The void we are feeling in that moment is the absence of our full self. The personal void opens when I am not here for myself, but am wishing for and believing in the messianic power of someone else, present or absent. The void is void of me. Here is the part that makes this process so paradoxical, enigmatic, and perplexing for us. Our numinous, that is spiritual, anima, animus, energy, male-female energy, usually can't be contacted without the articulation that comes from a specific person. This follows from our nature as incarnated beings who become who we are through mirroring by other beings. In our infancy, our parents gave us the five A's, and that's how we learned to love ourselves. Their hearts expressed an appreciation of our lovableness, and that enabled us to feel lovable in our own hearts. We found and have always found our inner source of nurturance through an external source of nurturance. But when we make a literal identification between a parent or partner and one of our own inner powers, we are confusing the archetypal universal image with a personal image, the channel with the source, the raft with the shore, the actor with the hero, the saint with the god, this man with our animus, this woman with our anima. This is how the parent or partner assumes such gigantic stature in our psyche. He becomes, rather than points to, our higher self. Letting go of attachment to people and things at the ego or literal level is a way to open ourselves to the Buddha mind, the enlightened consciousness behind all appearances. As the poet Rilke says, things live fully only in departure. Indeed, Aeneas recognized his goddess mother only when he said goodbye to her as his mortal helper. Yet our inner partner, our soul mate, our true higher power, cannot make his or her presence known to us except through the love we find in individuals. Someone has to show and tell us. Only then can we find ourselves, love ourselves, and marry our inner complementary parts, our male and female energies. These are the true soulmates. They are within ourselves. It is a mysterious and marvelous fact that it takes someone else to lead us to ourselves. No wonder we confuse our innermost longing for spiritual partnership with a tangible partnership and a specific person. We mistake this feather for the eagle it is meant to lead us to. Adults accept the fact that fulfillments are temporary, even momentary. They are satisfied with moments of the five A's perfectly given, happiness perfectly felt, or unconditional love perfectly received. Once we are adults, we see these moments as sustaining and sufficient. When we finally accept the impermanence that characterizes human existence, we stop looking, stop asking, stop manipulating, in an attempt to achieve permanence or perfection. Instead, we are immensely thankful for the moments. Still, no one can blame us for not getting relationships right in one lifetime. Our psyches were constructed with logic-defying and complicated mirth. It takes courageous depth and humor to get the point of it all and to follow the long winding road to wholeness. The challenge of mindfulness is to abandon our fascination with the magic lantern show put on by our egos and marvel instead at the inner pageant of images that continually arise unbidden from the depths of our own psyches. These images appear in dreams and in imagination, often bringing a message or healing. Any image that holds our attention or has archetypal dimensions may be a gift of the self. Our soul is images and is our soulmate. Staying in touch and intact. Ask your partner in your journal or directly, "Can I feel challenged instead of threatened by your reactions to me? Can I see you angry and not be enraged by it or scared by it? Can I see you depressed and not become morose? Can I see you feel anything and not be so scared of your feelings that I can't respond with the five A's?" Read the following paragraph to yourself and then to your partner. "I ask you to honor my tender core, which is not to be worn on a sleeve for all to see, but is an object of diligent search, revealed only to those willing to uncover it. The work it takes is the five A's, attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing me to be myself, to have the right to access my deepest needs, values, and wishes. I can be like a daisy, indiscriminately revealing its all to would-be lovers who then pull it to pieces. Or I can be like the peony that hides its core from view, but shares it generously with the conscientious bee that dares to linger in its depth and locate its sweetness. Yet too much safety is a barrier, not a boundary, around the sweetness of life and the risks that make it exciting. The danger in constructing boundaries is in our becoming too defensive. Do not a few falls and hurts help us grow and make us more daring? Confronting my fear of giving or receiving. How afraid I am to give. I could lose that way. If I give, you may want more, and I'll have nothing left. I can tell you about me, but not show my feelings. I always hold something back. I close my eyes when we make love, lest you seize my frightened soul. I can listen to your words and advise swiftly, never chancing a meeting with those dangerous strangers, your feelings, your hurts, your needs, your eyes. I want to live on top of our love, parceling out what I can most safely spare from this, my very guarded, frugal, and frightened heart. How afraid I am to receive. I avoid eye contact, for you might look too deeply. I don't like to be surprised or given a gift. That means receiving what you choose to give, and that scares me because I then am not in control. So I remain picky and hard to please. And if you do give me something, I have to be sure to give you something of equal value in return. I tense when you hug me. It is safer to sexualize any touch. I cannot be a sex partner and a friend. I can never reveal my needs to you, only my drives. I feel crowded by your supportive embrace. I keep myself self-sufficient. I never allow myself to need your help. I have to be the one who takes care of you, never putting myself at the mercy of your love. My capacity for self-reliance is thus a protective device. I fear depending on you, since dependency entails closeness. Rigid, constricted, shut down, ego-armed, I cannot let in appreciation or constructive criticism. I insist that you be perfect before I commit to you, and I remain attracted to younger, perfect types. You may have noticed that after dinner, I jump to clean up. Without the business of eating to occupy me, I might have to sit there seeing you and being seen. We might just look at each other too long, too closely. I can also be preoccupied with sports, with my computer, with the TV. I go out for a cigarette as a last resort. And by the way, I insist that you give me all your love and attention no matter what. Being mindful about giving and receiving. Mindful appreciation of your fears of giving and receiving means taking them as information without blaming others or feeling shame about yourself. Mindfulness is granting the 5 A's to the realities and limitations of your life and personality. Attend to them, appreciate them, allow them, feel affection for them, and accept them as they are. Sit quietly while paying attention to your breathing. One by one, grant each of the 5 A's to your fears of giving and receiving. The 5 A's can lead to cooperation and good feeling among people who work together. They are especially powerful when given by management to staff, as long as they are expressed sincerely and not as strategies to increase productivity, even though they may ultimately have that result. Give attention to co-workers' feelings and concerns, accept their gifts and limitations, appreciate their accomplishments and difficulties. Show personal affection and allow them their full range of responsibility while expressing your trust and encouragement. Find ways to put these suggestions into practice at your job or church or any other setting outside your home. What is the difference between caregiving and caretaking? Being compassionate does not mean becoming a caretaker, doing more than half the work. Compassion is respectful of the potential for self-activating power in others. Ask yourself, interiorly or in your journal, where you stand in the description of the differences between caregiving and caretaking. Caregiving supports the other person to do for himself. Caretaking does it for the other. Caregiving arises from a motivation to empower the other. Caretaking arises from a belief that the other is powerless. Caregiving seeks to make a contribution and then let go. Caretaking seeks to stay involved in the other's life. Caregiving facilitates the other in becoming a more effective adult. Caretaking takes over adult responsibilities and may infantilize the other. Caregiving teaches a skill for future use. Caretaking performs a skill and may continue to do so in the future. Caregiving is tailored to the other's willingness to be helped. Caretaking may be imposed whether it is sought or not. Caregiving maintains personal boundaries regarding how and when help is to be given. It is wisely conditional. Caretaking is willing to forsake personal boundaries to satisfy the other's needs. It is wildly unconditional. Caregiving is sincerely responsive to the needs of the other person. Caretaking may have as a primary agenda the satisfying of one's own needs. Caregiving is a form of respect. Caretaking may be a form of control. What is the difference between anger and abuse? Both mindful anger and hurtful abuse are visceral and involve raised voices, gesticulations, red faces, and intense eye contact. Yet there is a difference. Do you relate to your anger mindfully, or do you become possessed by your anger? True anger is authentic self-expression, the hero's way. Abuse, the shadow side of anger, is a theatrical display, the villain's way. True anger is always mindful. Abuse is ego-driven and caught in mindsets. True anger is a feeling. Abuse becomes a tantrum. True anger may be expressed with a red face, excited gestures, and a raised voice. Abuse is expressed with a red face, menacing gestures, expletives, and a screaming voice. True anger is a form of assertiveness that shows respect. Abuse is aggressive and attack. True anger shows tough love that enriches or repairs the relationship. Abuse explodes in rough and damaging mistreatment that endangers the relationship. True anger arises from displeasure at an injustice. Abuse arises from the sense of an affront to a bruised, indignant ego. True anger focuses on the injustice as intolerable but reparable. Abuse focuses on the other person as bad. True anger informs the other, creates rapt attention, and draws a mindful response. Abuse is meant to threaten the other and drives him or her away. True anger is meant to communicate, to report an impact. Abuse is meant to silence, intimidate, put down, bully, or dump on someone. True anger desires a response from the other, but does not require one. Abuse insists that the other acknowledge how right or justified one is. True anger asks for change, but allows the other to change or not. Abuse masks or expresses a controlling demand that the other change. True anger asks for accountability and amends. Abuse blames the other and takes revenge. True anger is about this present issue and is expressed freshly from incident to incident. Abuse is often a buildup of past, unresolved, unexpressed issues and displaced rage, gathering intensity from incident to incident. True anger has some perspective, can distinguish between minor and major issues. Abuse is trapped in the heat of the moment and explodes vehemently, no matter how minor the issue. True anger relates to the feeling. Abuse is possessed by the feeling. True anger coexists with other feelings. Abuse hides other feelings. True anger takes responsibility for one's own distress. Abuse diverts the blame for one's distress upon the other. True anger is nonviolent, in control, and always remains within self-limits, manages temper. Abuse is violent, out of control, derisive, punitive, hostile, and retaliatory, loses temper. True anger releases lively energy and leads to repose. Abuse derails lively energy and creates continuing stress. True anger is brief and lets go with a sense of closure. It's like a flare. Abuse is held onto as lingering resentment, hate, grudge, or bitterness. It's like a smoldering fire. True anger includes grief and acknowledges this. Abuse includes grief but masks it with feigned invulnerability or denial. True anger believes the other is a catalyst of the anger. Abuse believes the other is the cause of the anger. True anger treats the other as a peer. Abuse treats the other as a target. True anger originates in and fosters a healthy ego. Abuse originates in and perpetuates an arrogant ego. True anger aims at a deeper and more effective bond. An angry person moves toward the other. Abuse wants to get the rage out no matter who gets hurt. An abuser moves against the other. True anger coexists with and empowers love. It's fearless. Abuse cancels love in favor of fear. It's fear-based. True anger is a way of addressing, processing, and resolving something. Abuse is a way of avoiding one's own grief and distress. The word blame is from the Latin word for blaspheme. Blaming differs from assessing accountability. In blame, there is censure with an intent to shame and humiliate. The intent is to show that someone is wrong. In assessing accountability, the alternative to blaming, the intent is to right a wrong and to restore a